are listening to The Sector, the radio show podcast discussing the world of nonprofit, social justice, and activism. Broadcasting right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, as well as streaming live at citr.ca, and of course, via podcast, whenever, wherever, as technology permits. Well, hello and welcome. My name is Ethan Clow, your host here on The Sector, and this is episode 40. And we have a fantastic show this week. And of course, good morning to all of our listeners who are tuning in live. And of course, if you're listening via podcast, well, you know, welcome to the show, whatever time of day it is. It's a bit rainy, a bit kind of cold and dreary out, but you know what? It's spring. And we do get a bit of rain here, but it helps things grow, you know, stay green and bloom. And well, what can I say? It's not quite as exciting as having a bright sunny day, but we will manage. On today's show, we have a lot of great things to discuss, including some updates. There's been a lot of interesting news developments that have happened since last week's show that I want to kind of retouch base on, particularly the situation in Indiana with their religious freedom bill. There's also been some changes here in BC to the Societies Act, which I talked about back in episode 25. So I'll recap that, and a bit of good news, actually, so stay tuned for that. You may also notice that my voice sounds a lot closer to normal. I seem to have been getting over my flu quite sufficiently, and so I no longer sound like I have a walrus in my nose. But as my family has helpfully informed me, Ethan, you always kind of sound funny anyway. So there you have it. But speaking of being sick, do you find that when flu season comes around that you're one of the people who will say, no, I am not going into work with the flu. I'm going to stay home. I'm going to get better. And I am not going to infect my coworkers. Or are you one of those hardy people who refuses to be sent home or, you know, locked inside when you're sick? And whether you are, you know, throwing up or sneezing or coughing and hacking and wheezing, you're going to go to work and you're going to get your day's work done. And, you know, by golly, you're going to get paid for that day. You know, there's lots of different approaches to how we handle this. But I was recently looking at a survey by the Mornu Sheeple organization. And they had some interesting findings regarding employees who take time off work. Now, you might guess that based on what I'm talking about here, having a flu, that the big reason someone would take time off work is illness. But it turns out it's not. According to the survey results, 52% of employees responding to the survey said that illness was not the main reason they missed work. At the same time, 33% of employers responding did not list illness as one of the top three reasons why their employees are absent. The findings were part of the company's recent survey of employees, employers, and physicians across Canada. The survey indicated that 81% of employers addressed the issue of absenteeism with performance management, you know, sending warning letters, etc. And the majority indicated that unscheduled time off is a serious or extremely serious issue for their organization. Now, this is a bit ironic. I was actually having a conversation with somebody regarding the nonprofit sector and how it tends to differ from the for-profit industry. In that very subject of taking time off work, it seems that the nonprofit world, at least in my experience, maybe yours is a bit different, that it's a lot more forgiving of taking time off work. My reasoning is because the nonprofit sector is a lot more stressful and tends to have a lot less compensation. You know, not only in terms of your salary, but also your benefits. You don't tend to get the same kind of quality benefits, healthcare and dental and all that stuff from a for-profit company because they don't have as much money as a, you know, nonprofit doesn't have as much money as that big company, that big corporation. So they tend to be a bit more forgiving also because, you know, with a nonprofit sector, not only are you paid less, but you are sort of always on the clock. there's always going to be that potential for a phone call at 9 o'clock at night, you know, saying something like, oh, we, you know, didn't get that big donation, or there's something wrong with our social media, or this campaign is getting negative press. There's always that potential to be called in at, you know, bizarre hours. So the nonprofit sector tends to be a bit more, well, it gives a bit more leeway, a bit more concerned about things like burnout and stress and, you know, workplace functionality. Nevertheless, this survey is pretty interesting. As the survey concludes, likely the reason that employees take off time from work when they have a non-medical reason is due to high work-related stress. And according to the survey, it's a very common practice in organizations to require a medical note to validate absence. Now, this doesn't really help the issue. It actually may create different problems. The physician respondents to the survey indicate that there's limited value in providing medical notes. Only 5% of physicians commenting indicated that medical notes reduce unnecessary absenteeism. Comments from physician respondents included, quote, I do not know if the employee was sick since they came to see me after they are better. Quote, using the family doctor is as police, in effect, may delay return to work as patients wait until the note has been issued. And of course, quote, truancy management is not a medical service. I mean, all good points, of course. When it comes to managing longer-term leave, the research found that almost half of the physicians do not feel comfortable commenting on how health conditions impact work performance. At the same time, approximately 3 out of every 4 physicians indicated that workplaces needed to do a better job in understanding the very issue and how they accommodate the limitations of employees with serious or chronic conditions. Now, this could apply very easily to stress as well. If you're an employee and you're feeling stressed and you need to get a break, calling in with the flu is one thing, but being forced to go to your physician to get a note, well, I mean, again, it's adding extra stress. If the workplace just had a system in place to say, okay, we trust that you need a break, let's work out a system, it might be better off for everybody involved. So what do you all think? What's your workplace like? If you're in the nonprofit sector, do you have a different system than, say, a for-profit system? Let us know. You can email us at sectorpodcast@gmail.com. Of course, you can tweet us at Sector Podcast, or at Ethan Clow, that's me, on Twitter. Well, let's take a quick break here on the show. When we come back, we will dive more into the world of social justice, activism, and nonprofits.
Bam!
Peanut butter and jam!
What the f*** are you doing, Phil?
Right now, it's time to...
Peanut butter.
Damn.
First you dig peanuts and you dig 'em. You dig 'em. Then you crush 'em. You crush 'em. Then you spread 'em. You spread 'em. Peanut butter.
Damn.
Peanut butter.
If you're looking for the best in local music and local food, it's got to be Peanut Butter and Jams with your hosts Brenda and Jordy, alternating Thursdays 6 to 7:30. Check it out.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants!
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit CITR.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
And we are back here on The Sector with me, Ethan Clow, on CITR. Well, many of you, I'm sure, fans of the show, are also fans of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Now, unless you've been living under a rock, you know that earlier this week, they announced the replacement for Jon Stewart, who is leaving the show after, 10, 12, how many ever years he's been doing that. And the replacement, of course, is Trevor Noah, the South African comedian who recently made his debut on The Daily Show a number of weeks ago. I think he's been in about 3 or 4 sketches since then. And I remember seeing a couple of them, and he's kind of a funny guy. He sort of plays a straight man, kind of similar to maybe like Stephen Colbert in that sense. Anyway, the internet quickly heard the news that Trevor Noah was replacing Jon Stewart, which led to kind of a lot of eager speculation about what kind of a host Noah would be. Would he be a bit more this or that? Would he be more charismatic or less charismatic? How would he portray himself? Would he be more sort of like John Oliver or Stephen Colbert or David Letterman, or who knows, right? Lots of excitement, lots of discussion about the future of The Daily Show. But then, you know, curious fans started to dig through Noah's Twitter account looking at some of his past jokes. And what they found was a little bit disturbing. It turns out that Noah has a bit of a history with some rather bad jokes. And bad in the sense that you have jokes that just kind of aren't funny. But then you had jokes that were being labeled as sexist or, in some cases, anti-Semitic. And in some cases, kind of virulently misogynistic. Now, this, of course, sparked some considerable backlash. I mean, The Daily Show is known for being a place for progressive comedy. Obviously, that bar was set by Jon Stewart and, you know, the rest of The Daily Show correspondents. And this sort of struck people as being a bit more, maybe a bit more a place in a comedy club, but not really the voice they want for The Daily Show. Now, predictably, this backlash went on for hours, days, sparking, of course, a counter backlash. And as with all things on the internet these days, a counter backlash. And now we've gotten into sort of the meta criticism level where we're starting to dissect the initial criticism and dissect the initial criticism of the criticism that went on before the criticism. I don't know. I've lost my train of thought. Look, the point being is it has raised, I think, some legitimate questions. Now, from our point of view here on The Sector, normally I try to kind of avoid sort of social media faux pas and arguments simply because I feel that they're not really productive for any kind of intelligent conversation. But that being said, you know, given the role that The Daily Show has played in kind of shaping, you know, liberalism and progressive politics for the last 10 years, I mean, a lot of people of my generation and younger, Jon Stewart has been kind of a oasis in kind of a desert of sensationalist, exploitive, and, you know, in some cases, bold-faced media lies. So when, you know, someone is replacing him, that's a pretty big deal. When we also consider the role that Twitter has played in activism, I think it becomes very, you know, germane for the subject of our show here on The Sector to analyze that a little bit, especially considering that Twitter has in many ways actually replaced, you know, real-world physical activism. And this whole question of, you know, what is the role of online media in shaping and helping us understand the way that we engage on activism topics? Now, that, again, you know, that's all great, well and good. It loops back to the question, of course, of is Trevor Noah's Twitter history all that important, or is it just a bunch of, you know, jokes that fell flat? That's an interesting question. It should be pointed out that Noah has since posted a brief response on Twitter, and the Comedy Central people have reaffirmed their support for him, suggesting that, you know, he's an edgy comedian, et cetera, et cetera. What's interesting, though, is I saw an interview with Asif Manvi, who is one of the really popular Daily Show correspondents, and he was asked about this. And I want to quote a few things from what he said. Quote, I think it's much ado about nothing. Quote, the guy made some sort of, you know, off-color, irresponsible tweets, but he was trying to be funny. I think the millennials understand this more than the people who are sort of upset about this. And quote, are we going to hold artists, comedians, whatever it is, responsible for the stuff they say on Twitter? You can if you want, but I don't know what that means about our culture, you know? And I thought about that for a little bit, and I kind of have to say, well, you know, shouldn't we be holding people responsible for what they say on Twitter? I mean, Twitter is self-expression, yes? Like, what is the point of having self-expression if you can't be held responsible for what you say? If I come out here on the sector and I say something that I don't really believe or that I don't stand behind, well, doesn't that kind of defeat the purpose of me having a radio show or podcast in general? If I say something that's offensive, and, you know, listeners call in to the station and they complain to the station manager and the program coordinator and whatnot. You know, if I come back and say, well, you know, hold on, everybody, it was just a podcast. It was just a radio show. Well, yeah, sure, of course it is. But that's the whole point. If I'm vocalizing my thoughts as I am right now and sharing them with you, the listener, on a media platform, should I not be held to a certain degree of responsibility when I say what I say? Likewise, with a comedian, if we don't judge them based on their jokes and the quality of those jokes, how do we determine if they are a good comedian? I mean, if we're going to say that comedians have kind of a free rein on Twitter or really any other platform, then, you know, there's really no way to sort of say something objectively definitive when it comes to comedy. You could basically just say that a comedian that you've never heard of is as good or better than someone like Louis C.K. or Jerry Seinfeld or Mel Brooks. But we wouldn't really say that, of course, because we know that these comedians are really funny and really insightful and really good. You would never take that standard any further. So why would we just apply to Twitter then? It doesn't really make a lot of sense. Of course, you know, what many people would say is that there are more than just an issue of Trevor Noah's potential racist or misogynistic leanings being shown here. Is this also a function of the times and that we are seeing kind of a overzealous, politically correct, assault on this guy when really we haven't had a chance to get to know him as a comedian or as a presenter? If he is, as always, as he says, just testing material and evolving as a comedian, you know, are we going to say that someone like Jon Stewart or Louis C.K. has never said something regrettable that they would later go back and, you know, wipe off? Now, what's interesting, of course, is that that is sort of the central premise of a lot of his defenders. And maybe that's true. But then again, do we also have to accept that as the baseline? You know, if there is a benchmark being set here, are we required to maintain it? Or are we not obligated to seek a better benchmark or to seek a higher quality? You know, that's again, I'm throwing that question out there, that just because the bar has been set at a certain height doesn't mean we can't try to make that bar a bit better, you know, raise it and expect a bit more when it comes to comedians. You know, the social media age has given us the ability to share our thoughts and express ourselves in a public forum. That does not come without risk. And I think when you sign up for Twitter, you are accepting part of that risk. There, you know, most of us are not going to become the new host of The Daily Show. But for those of us who have that potential, you kind of have to keep that in mind when you are out there sharing your material. You want to make sure that when somebody reads it, they can understand that you're making a joke, that you are satirizing a position and not making a moral, ethical statement. You know, one final point on this. I did see a Twitter rant by comedian Patton Oswalt, and I normally like him, but he really seemed to be missing the whole point. like, I don't know if he's familiar with the term straw man, but he was definitely creating a straw man argument. That's where you create this sort of caricature of a statement and then knock it down, like a straw man, right? And that's what sort of he was doing, creating this fake sort of PC, politically correct response to a simple joke. Now, the problem, of course, is that Trevor Noah wasn't making a, quote, simple joke. He made a joke that, several jokes, actually, that specifically, like, referenced premises that realistically can very easily be construed as either anti-Semitic, misogynistic, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, the point being is that Oswald would seem to be saying that in this day and age of the internet, of Twitter, of social media, and political correctness, that you can't even say something bad. You don't even have the right to be wrong. You have this immediate response, and it ignores the attempt to be funny and focuses in on the result of offending. Whether or not that's true remains to be seen. I don't think it is. But I think that the real question here that we're sort of waiting for a response, or at least that I'm kind of curious about, is how does Noah respond to this? And I know that he's already kind of issued a few remarks, but if the response is lighten up, it's only a joke, or some form of that, then I think that's a bigger statement about his personality and his, indeed his career as a comedian, versus if he says something along the lines of, you know what, I was trying to be funny, I failed, I failed badly, I'm sorry if it, came out the wrong way, sometimes I'm going to make these mistakes, et cetera, et cetera. If he's more understanding, then that, I think, says a lot about his character and his evolution as a comedian. So that's going to be the more interesting factor for this. And I think that the kind of the knee-jerk kind of response from either the sort of boycott the Daily Show crowd or the relax is only a joke crowd, as sort of Patton Oswalt, I think, stupidly demonstrated, is not going to be the ultimate end-all be-all of this, kerfuffle. More interesting is going to be how this evolves, and we'll see what kind of comedian he really is. Well, let's take a quick break here on the show. We'll be back after this.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts on Commercial Drive and other areas at
Bone Rattle Music Limited, High Life Records, People's Co-op Bookstore, Audiopile Records, Bad Bird Media, Band Merch Canada, Vancouver Music Gallery, and Pandora's Box Rehearsal Studios.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance, get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's nonprofit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
It's getting better, it's a little better, all the time.
Can't get no worse.
I have to admit, it's getting better, it's getting better since you've been mine.
And we are back here on The Sector talking about nonprofits, social justice, and activism with me, Ethan Clow. Now, back on episode 24 of The Sector, I talked about the BC government and the new Societies Act. Now, this was problematic in a lot of different ways, but mainly because the New Societies Act would allow anyone who believes that a society, a nonprofit society that is acting to the detriment of public interest, could file a court petition against that society. Now, why would that be a bad thing, you might ask? Well, imagine if you had an environmental nonprofit, and it started putting out education or literature or material about the oil sands or the dangers of a pipeline or environmental threats that could be happening in the province of BC. Now, any citizens, concerned citizens, perhaps working for a oil corporation, could file legal papers against that nonprofit, essentially saying that what they are stating, what they are doing in their outreach and their campaigning is creating a detriment to public interest. And that could be very, you know, fluidly defined. Public interest could be economic interest. It could be the interest of job seekers or tradesmen or anybody, really. And if you can spin any particular cause to having some kind of impact on public interest, regardless of what it could be, you would be essentially able to tie up BC nonprofits in court indefinitely. Any situation that came up could be countermeasured by saying, well, this nonprofit, when they're saying that they have environmental concerns, when they are saying that they have pro-democracy concerns, when they have concerns over police or civil liberties or anything, they could be sued. And this, of course, is a huge impact on their ability to do the work that they do. It's a huge impact on their ability to fund their operations. So when the news of this came out, there was a concerted effort by progressives and activists in BC to make this change. The BC Environmental Law Association even put out a petition. It was followed up by letters to MPs and or MLAs and other important people in the BC legislature. And the good news, they've listened. On March 25th, the bill, Bill 24, the Societies Act, was introduced in BC legislature. The controversial Section 99, which, as I just mentioned, allowed nonprofits to be sued, has been dropped. Now, not only is this good news, but it actually showcases a really, well, surprisingly good interaction between the lawmakers, in this case the BC government, and the constituencies of that law, namely the nonprofits. The fact that they were able to recognize a serious flaw in this legislation, garner support, mobilize the base of nonprofits in BC, and additionally reach out to the many, many activists who call BC home, and they were able to explain, you know, what the problems were with this bill, why it shouldn't be allowed to proceed, what would be the potential and the opportunity for abuse using this new bill. They were able to communicate that to the lawmakers, and they actually listened. And that, I think, is an impressive and hopeful thing going forward. It would be so much easier, I think, for lawmakers in this country if we had this kind of back and forth dialogue about how to craft things, especially for an industry or a sector like the nonprofit sector, when it includes their feedback, when you are giving them information about what you have in mind and they can say, well, actually, this is going to really adversely impact us because of this, this, and this. You listen to that feedback, and then you're able to craft something even better. In fact, in looking over some of the highlights from Bill 24, many of them, I think, are a long time coming, and in fact, I think will greatly increase the flexibility and accountability for nonprofits, as well as provide them with some more modern and, you know, up-to-date rules and regulations that hopefully will make them their operation a lot easier and, I think, involve their membership bases a lot more. You know, for instance, just a simple thing of using electronic filing and records for societies that would just, again, that's just going to make things a lot easier. societies can be established by a single incorporator rather than the five as currently required. There's more flexibility for creating voting and non-voting member classes. A two-thirds majority approval for special resolutions by members, for example, to change the bylaws, unless the bylaws provide for a higher threshold. A new right for a minimum of 5% of voting members to make a proposal for consideration at an AGM, with procedures for preventing hijacking of member meetings. So again, all of these things are really useful and can really help a nonprofit stay up to date and stay flexible in terms of moving forward with changes to bylaws, to adding new rules and regulations for their operation. You know, typically those type of things are always a real headache and they just drain resources. You have to spend months prepping documentation, filing the right paperwork, getting your votes together. And there's always these antiquated and really draconian systems already in place that usually throw monkey wrenches into the whole process. You know, I know that I've experienced that firsthand many times. And this just looks like a real sort of breath of fresh air. And again, the feedback was so great. The fact that the government didn't try to dig their heels in and actually listened. I mean, that's refreshing. You know, you would think this is the sort of thing that the, Conservative government of Canada ought to look at and learn from. You know, the whole idea of unilaterally making decisions and ignoring feedback and ignoring criticism, that doesn't always work out so well. So, you know, cheers to this for actually demonstrating that with, you know, concerted effort and activism and careful planning, you can make a new Societies Act, which is really, well, awesome, frankly. Now, speaking of changing one's mind based on feedback. Last week on the show, we talked about the Religious Freedom Bill that had been passed in Indiana by Republican Governor Mike Pence. Now, the initial law basically allowed you to refuse service to gay, lesbian, bisexual, transsexual Americans if you felt that your religious conviction was more important than their civil rights. Obviously, a lot of people, not just in Indiana, but around America, around the world, everywhere, thought this was disgusting and have let Indiana know over the last week. What's interesting, of course, is that Mike Pence, when he was promoting this law out there in media, talking about it, campaigning for it, he was unapologetic about the religious freedomness of this law. The fact that it was not about discrimination, it was about protecting Christians in America from having to deal with the gays. Now, the backlash has been both, in my opinion, surprising, but also really interesting. Now, it came from the usual suspects, I think, as well. I was watching David Letterman's show, and he did a couple segments really blasting Mike Pence, but also, I think, really putting in a lot of really good commentary on the fact that this is about discrimination. This is about depriving a certain group of people in America of the same rights and freedoms that everybody else automatically has. That, I think, goes a long way towards convincing people in America. It's one thing when it comes from a well-known progressive liberal, but when it comes from someone like David Letterman, that has, I think, more impact. He's got more, you know, leeway with middle America than, say, someone like Jon Stewart does. And it wasn't just David Letterman who was chastising Indiana. Seth Meyers, host of Late Night with Seth Meyers, also did a rather scathing segment, which is kind of interesting because he's sort of more of the least controversial of late night talk show hosts. And actually, I want to play a clip from that just because I think it is quite good. And let's just take a listen to that right now.
On Thursday of last week, Indiana Governor Mike Pence signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law. Now, some claim This is simply a defense of religious freedoms. Others say it will allow businesses to deny service to gays and lesbians. Let's take a closer look in a segment we call A Couple Things. Now, one of the reasons to think this law will allow people to refuse to participate in a gay wedding are the words of Eric Miller, a supporter of the bill, who wrote on Advance America, "Christian bakers, florists, and photographers should not be punished for refusing to participate in a homosexual marriage." Now, the words in this sentence are very telling. Even more telling, the use of an exclamation point. You think that's bad? He originally had four of them, and the words were all caps. Second thing, Governor Pence appeared on ABC's This Week yesterday to clarify the law and assure everyone it wasn't discriminatory, and he did what can only be described as a terrible job. Multiple times, George Stephanopoulos asked the governor if it would be legal for businesses to deny service to a gay couple, and Pence went an impressive ofer.
Is Advance America right when they say a florist in Indiana can now refuse to serve a gay couple without fear of punishment?
Well, let me explain.
If a florist in Indiana refuses to serve a gay couple at their wedding, is that legal now in Indiana?
George.
It said it would protect a Christian florist who against any kind of punishment. Is that true or not?
George.
Does that mean that Christians who want to refuse service, or people of any other faith who want to refuse service to gays and lesbians, that it's now legal in the state of Indiana? That's a simple yes or no question.
George,
do you think it should be legal in the state of Indiana to discriminate against gays or lesbians?
George.
Yes or no, should it be legal to discriminate against gays and lesbians?
George.
No one is better at playing yes, no, or George than Governor Mike Pence. Thanks to Pence, Indiana also passed a law that on the SATs you can answer true, false, or Linda. Third thing, now Pence and many others made the claim that 19 other states and the federal government have the same laws on the books. That's kind of true, but the federal government and most of those states also have civil rights protections for gays and lesbians. Stephanopoulos asked Pence if he had any intention of adding similar protections in Indiana. But before we show you his answer, remember, Pence is very bad at being concise.
One fix that people have talked about is simply adding sexual orientation as a protected class under the state civil rights laws. Will you push for that?
I will not push for that.
Oh, so you can answer a question. Next thing, many conservatives are pointing out that Bill Clinton signed the federal bill into law and Barack Obama voted for a similar law in Illinois. But the original Religious Freedom Restoration Act was actually designed to protect Native Americans against being fired for taking peyote as part of their religious ceremonies, which, by the way, is the least we can do for the Native Americans. Not only is the Indiana law broader than the federal law in the other 19 states, remember, when Bill Clinton signed the law, gay marriage wasn't legal. In fact, the only people who could imagine legal gay marriage in 1993 were the people taking peyote. How was your vision quest? Amazing. I saw two dudes get married. A rainbow licked my face. My fingers turned into sparklers. Another thing. Arizona considered passing a similar law, but Governor Jan Brewer backed down to pressure from the business community, and the same pressure is happening in Indiana now. The NCAA, Apple, and Yelp have all protested the law and threatened not to expand their operations in Indiana. And Yelp went so far as to give Indiana a scathing review. Also, Apple announced they're leaving China, and the NCAA announced they're going to start paying student-athletes. Nah. I'm just with you. Last thing, even though Barack Obama voted for the Illinois version of the law 17 years ago, he should explain why he did it, and he should explain why this law is different. And when asked to clarify, I hope the president can give a better answer than...
George.
We'll be right back with more Late Night.
So as you can see, fairly strong words from Seth Meyers. And, you know, this is the whole interesting thing about the backlash against Indiana and Mike Pence is that it's not just the usual suspects, the usual sort of liberal media. It's coming from different corners of it. And that, I think, demonstrates the sort of central zeitgeist of the population. On last week's show, I talked about Gen Con, the big gaming convention that happens in Indiana
and which brings in about $50 million for the state's economy. It's been there for the last 10 years or so. When the law came up and then later was put on the books, Gen Con threatened to leave Indiana. They have since updated their position. tweet, so you don't have to worry about me making any kind of bad jokes that would later disqualify me from hosting a major network comedy show. Not that that was going to happen anyway, but just putting it out there. As for future topics here on The Sector, I am open to suggestions. Let me know. Use those communication channels that I just gave you. I'm happy to entertain ideas. If there are any particular topics relating to nonprofits or charities you'd like me to dive into, feel free to tell me. If there's anyone who I should interview, if you have questions for a particular guest or someone you think has very interesting opinions on nonprofits or social justice, let me know and I will try to get a hold of them. And of course, if you have any events, activism, or theories of activism that you wish to discuss with me, let me know. I'm more than happy to dive into many different topics. On a later show, I do want to get more in depth into the conservative government's anti-terror bill, the so-called privacy bill, the so-called invasion of privacy bill, and talk a bit about the political reaction to it, how it is changing the political landscape in Canada. The Liberals announced that they would support the bill. I mean, a shocking development if there ever was one. The result has catapulted the NDP ahead of them in the polls. With an election coming up, what can we expect here in Canada? Ultimately, what do we want here in Canada? That's an interesting topic. I mean, maybe I'd like to get your feedback on that. What kind of government do you envision? What do you hope for? And ultimately, what do you think will help this country? So, lots to look forward to here on The Sector. This has been episode 40. My thanks for tuning in, listening, or downloading the podcast. I hope to see you all next week here for episode 41. In the meantime, I will wrap things up. Coming up next on CITR is Up on the Roof. This is Ethan Clough, host of The Sector, saying thanks for listening. See you all next week. Have a great weekend, everybody.